Welcome back to the Matt Pfeiffer Experience. I am your host, Matthew Pfeiffer, and today I have on a very special guest, Brian Blitz, all the way out in Chicago. And I know it's probably just as cold there as it is here in Dallas. And he is someone that I came acquainted with over on Instagram. And if you've been following me for a while, if you've been following the podcast for a while, you guys know I don't bring on people that I wouldn't recommend myself to friends, to family members, people who are attorneys who are doing a good job. They have a bad rap. And so we like to bring on people that we know, like, and trust. And so with that being said, let me turn it over to our guest. Brian, welcome to the show. And tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got started.
Hi, Matt. Thank you for having me. I think we have, to a certain extent, rightfully deserved a bad rap. But hopefully I can undo some of that today. And it sounds like the people that you've met with before have done the same. So, yes, I've been a matrimonial family lawyer for going on 21 years now. I'm the first lawyer within my immediate family, parents, grandparents. Like a lot of families that immigrated from Eastern Europe, we were in a family business on the south side of Chicago for many generations, three. And got into the law business kind of at the encouragement of my parents, who very much wanted my brother and me to become professionals. Family law kind of found me. I think a lot of people will say that. I did my first family law stint as a first-year law student over a summer, working for a crazy group of people that kind of intoxicated me and made me feel like the pace, the stories, the hands-on experience with clients was something that I would enjoy, that I'd be good at. And I think the real question, not only did I get started in this business, but why I've stayed in this line of work, has been that over time, what I have come to find is that the relationships that I've enjoyed with so many of my clients have enriched me so much, and continuing to find those rewarding relationships with people that trust me with so much to represent them in such a hard part of their lives really is what gets me excited to come to work and take care of people every day. Yep. So that's how I got started, and that's why I stuck with it.
And did you come out of law school? You obviously started right away, but going into law school, did you know that you wanted to go into family law, or was it?
I thought I didn't. I really thought I didn't. It was one of those things where when you go to law school, you're in a strange way brainwashed that you want to go out and go work for a big firm and be in an office environment like that without really knowing much other than that. And I went to the University of Illinois for law school. Yeah. So recruiting into the Chicago big legal market was something that was very important to the school. They wanted as many people employed, making as much money early on as possible. So that was kind of where I thought I was going to go. And then when I had this experience as a first year law student, I realized a much smaller environment where I could be really hands on with people and develop my own style. Yeah. And my own sensibilities, and over time, understand that I could care for people in the way that I felt was right for them.
Yeah.
That's what's always felt right to me. And I've been lucky that I've been able to really develop that style, really thankfully to a certain extent through my partners at Berger Schatz, who have always encouraged me to develop my own sense of myself, my own person as a lawyer. And I think that that's why it's important who you pick to be your lawyer, because you got to pick somebody that's authentic and somebody that views the world the way that you do.
We're going to talk about that here in a second, about picking the right lawyer for, because I know that you specialize in like a certain type of background that you work with. So we're definitely going to touch on that. But one of the things that I wanted to kind of touch on with your transition into family law out of law school is, one of the things I found out is that a lot of attorneys, they really genuinely care about their clients. And that sounds kind of, sounds a lot like you. And not only do you care a lot about your clients, but you actually, and this is like counter to what the stereotype is about family law attorneys, you genuinely believe in marriage and relationships and yourself. You mentioned, you know, one of the first things that you mentioned during the pre-recording is that you've been married for 19 years. And that's something I found very true to a lot of family law and divorce attorneys, is that they really genuinely believe in marriage and believe in people working things out, and also even giving people, you know, going into even a second marriage and, you know, giving love a second chance and things of that nature. Can you talk a little bit about the reasons why and why that belief is so strong within that niche?
Such a fascinating observation, by the way, and I agree with you, interestingly enough. For me, I have always found personally, my parents really, I think, were great role models in the work it took to make a successful marriage. They just celebrated their 50th wedding anniversary last summer. And for me personally, my wife and I work very hard at it, but we've got a wonderful relationship. And having that stability at home when I deal with a lot of professional chaos feels good and feels right. And, you know, I love that. And I love her and I love what we've built together, even though any relationship that you want to sustain and pass the test of time takes a lot of work.
Right.
With respect to my clients, I would say one of the most important things that I think that we can offer people, in addition to our legal expertise and our caretaking abilities, is optimism and a light at the end of the tunnel. And the notion of someone coming through, and we touched upon this a little bit right before we went live, the notion that somebody would end this relationship and not feel glass half full, that they could go out and find love again and find fulfillment in relationships and be cynical, skeptical, not trusting.
Right.
That's not what I want people to feel when they finish their experience with me. I want them to believe in love, believe that happiness comes from being in a wonderful relationship, put themselves back out there. Being out there also is self-confidence and feeling like that person is out there and feeling good about yourself and having somebody feel make you feel good about yourself that can take care of you, that you can take care of. I find all of those things to be really rewarding and really important for people. So I probably started from where I started. And then, yeah, I think that that's a level of glass half fullness that I really want my clients to feel and experience.
I've noticed one of the things people who followed for a while, they, you know, I used to interview a lot of therapists and then we started interviewing coaches. We still do that every once in a while. But I find that attorneys give some fantastic, fantastic relationship advice. You know, because they see things at the, you know, see things at the end or breaking the, you know, and they see a lot of the pitfalls and you're able to kind of see like where this kind of went wrong. What would you say are the common themes that you see, like when people come in and see you, where you're like, you know what, I can kind of see where this broke down, or these are the elements, or these are the patterns that I typically see that typically pile up to a point where it's just a point of no return. Like, what are some pitfalls that people should avoid or that they should look into, like before they get into that relationship, or like that they should probably nip in the bud before it starts to get out of hand?
Another wonderful observation. So I'll say this, when you say that a lot of times therapists or coaches may not give advice, you know, we're paid to give advice. Yeah. So some of the things that we say to people, we tend to be a little bit more blunt, and as opposed to a therapist, right, you figure certain things out for yourself and work on these things. I think we pretty much tell people what we think. Sometimes it's what they want to hear. Sometimes it's not. So maybe that's a distinction right there. And so far as why you feel like lawyers are giving the advice and maybe therapists are, well, I don't know. So I would say this in so far as my observations over time, and I think we have to be good observers in what we do too and read people. Number one, you're never going to really fix anybody.
Right.
And I think when you see somebody, especially at the stage of life, middle age, older, the notion that you're going to come in and fix somebody or care for them and make them into something that you want is a fiction and a fantasy. Mm-hmm. So I think that that's one. Number two, early on in a relationship, you really shouldn't have to work that hard at it. And when people say to me early on that there were red flags from the beginning when they walked down the aisle and that they thought at that time that maybe this wasn't going to work, but they were committed to working on it, it should be easy at the beginning.
Yeah.
And there's always certain things that people tend to fight about that become the straw that breaks the camel's back. Money, extended family, children, where you're going to live. If those major life decisions are things that you're not in sync with early on, you probably should be with somebody else. And those are the things I think early on where I can say, oh, this thing was doomed from the beginning. Yep. Or conversely, and maybe more optimistically, you all should be able to work through this a little bit. I'm not sure that this is a reason that you should be sitting in my office right now. Let's get you all some help, assuming everybody's wedded to the notion of working at this.
One of the things that you bring up a great point about the beginning stages. One of the things I've noticed with people is I always say that people kind of get the stages of like dating and relationship stuff like mixed up. Like people like in the beginning when you're dating and it should be like red flags or deal breakers, people are giving, I tell people that person hasn't earned the right for you to work through this. Like if someone's cheating on you, like in the first 3 to 6 months, that should be a deal breaker. Not like, okay, we have three kids. We've been married for 25 years. We have three houses. Like that, now that's a difficult decision. That shouldn't be a, like, let's go to therapy and try to work things out. That's a, like, we have a possible habitual situation here, and, you know, a deal breaker. And I think that people kind of get that confused, like the dating stage or like getting to know you stage versus like, yeah, we've built this life and this is a difficult decision that might need to like, you know, might need to like try to work this out before I go see Brian Blitz.
Some things are worth fighting for and some things just aren't.
Right.
I agree. I completely agree with that.
So you work with a particular type of, and I would say that most people, like at least most family law attorneys that we work with, that we talk to, work with a particular type of client. And you work with more of the affluent type, more of like the athlete, more of possibly people that we possibly see like in the news and that sort of thing. Was there any particular reason why you got into that, or are there any differences between a divorce of that magnitude versus like your, I would say like middle class divorce?
I think people are people. And when I got into this line of work, I always thought that the big, sexy, complicated cases were the most interesting based on, we have to know so much about so much. I have to know not only somebody's intimate details about their relationship, but also how to value their business, how they manage their household every single month, how they earn income in a bunch of different, I would say, unorthodox ways, whether it's carried interests in the private equity world or stock option grants and those things, which are just interesting to really peel the layers of the onion with those things. But I would say people are people. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't suggest that any of the cases or any of the clients that I've represented over the years have any more worth than anybody else on any level at all. Things that may distinguish these cases a little bit to a certain extent, and certainly not every case that walks in the door is a celebrity case.
Right.
But you learn a lot about people in that area. And I would tell you that the problems that you see in any other part of the world exist in that part of the world too, sometimes even on steroids and even more so. People have more money to feed bad habits. I would say that, sure, the financial complications in a lot of those cases certainly can be, I would say, more intense, more strategy to work through them. But you still have to set simple goals with people at the beginning. And insofar as maybe additional challenges in that world, number one, people with a lot of money sometimes think that they're entitled to certain things. And I think you have to really try to preach humility. And I think that that's a very important trait for all of us to possess. You can't let people with resources tell you how to do your job. And the reality is that I feel like I know better in certain circumstances than someone else. And if they think that they know everything, they can find someone else to do it. There's certain sensibilities that I won't stray from in the way that I represent people or care for people. And I would say insofar as public cases go, what you come to understand is that the best thing you can do for people that are maybe a little bit more in the public spotlight is to keep all of these affairs private. And you won't see my name anywhere insofar as speaking to any of the public clients that I've had. If anything, I've even suggested to them in an honest moment that they shouldn't be public with their own affairs either. It's not about me. It's not about putting my own name out there at all. It's really about, nobody generally looks good when things like that become a public spectacle. And privacy is so important, which is why we're doing a lot of work in mediation now, keeping people out of a courtroom. And I mean, I'm reminded every single day also that money doesn't buy happiness. That's for sure.
You bring up a really good point. And I obviously with my background, I talk a lot about toxic relationships. And one of the things that happens, especially during breakups and divorce, is that all of a sudden there's a smear campaign, especially now with the digital age, with social media. And I imagine that at that level, at that magnitude, you know, now some of these people have this target on their back where this can potentially be used as leverage where, you know, I'm going to tell everyone about, you know, our bedroom life, or I'm going to do this. I have recordings of this, or I have the recordings of you yelling at me. And I'm assuming that could harm people's not only reputation, but also, you know, their job situation or, you know,
parents or children, yeah, really, at the end of the day.
So what do you typically recommend? And, you know, for people who are going through those situations, because we, you know, it seems like we see that. I don't know if it's happening more often just because we see it on social media or
sure.
if it's just in front of us because of those sorts of things.
So I don't like to listen to people's recordings. People may say I recorded my husband doing this or I recorded my wife doing that. And if they didn't know they were being recorded, first and foremost, you've got a federal eavesdropping statute problem. Uh-huh. So I'm not going to be complicit with that. And I also think, and I'm a holistic guy when it comes to how to live your life. And I think in the world, and you touched upon this, and just to kind of summarize it, little things become big things in the context of a divorce. Anybody that wants to hear any of the things that you're referencing, insofar as whether it's something that you see on social media, where it's like you're looking at a car wreck and you have to look, or anything that may happen in the inner details of somebody's life that's coming from one side of a contested relationship. Anybody that wants to hear that is probably someone that you wouldn't want to be talking to anyways, because most people don't really want to hear those things is what I would say. And generally, I tell my own clients, keep your mouth shut, that if you're out there saying these things about your spouse, what it's really speaking to is how you look to other people, mm-hmm. not how that other person looks to other people. And I think it is so important in our line of work to balance this objectivity so you can see solutions clearly with still being nurturing and empathic to people.
Yeah.
And I think once you start really micromanaging every little thing that somebody does on a daily basis, which we all screw up throughout every single day, you really lose sight of the finish line, which is where you really need to bring people so that you can launch them into their next phase of their life. Yeah. So that's my view.
One of the things that people say oftentimes to play devil's advocate for their reasoning behind like actually going on social media and saying things about the other person is, you know, they should be able to tell their side of the story. You know, people need to know how this person is behind closed doors. And I've always been, I lean towards like same thing that you say. This isn't going to help your court case. It definitely can hurt it. But it's not going to help your case. And oftentimes people forget that, you know, even in the worst case scenario, you're still going to have to deal with this person after the divorce, especially if you share children and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And so have you seen situations where, you know, going on social media and talking about what's happened where it's actually hurt someone's case?
Oh, social media bites people in the ass all the time. Yeah. The public nature of it, the printouts of Facebook or Instagram posts, you are putting yourself out there. And here, and here's another thing that you mentioned that triggered something in my mind. The notion of helping or hurting your court case, or even more so, the notion that like your day in court will bring justice and the story will be told. Here's the harsh reality. Judges don't give a shit.
Yeah.
Okay. They've got lots of cases on their call. You're not that important. This isn't Law and Order or Suits. Odds are there's not going to be an aha moment in court where all of a sudden you just won this game of gotcha. Courtroom battles and talking to somebody that's litigated for 20 plus years, so battle tested, courtroom battles for the most part are horribly expensive, horribly unpredictable, and seldom result in the outcome that people want, feeling as if their entire story has been validated. I generally tell people to delete certain words from their vocabulary once they enter my realm. Winning, losing, justice, offense, defense, principle, control. Those are words that are illusory. If you're going to kind of get hung up on those kinds of feelings as opposed to real solutions, it's going to be a really long, painful process because you're not going to achieve those things.
Can I toss one other word at you and get your thoughts on it?
I would love you to. I'll use it.
Yep. Narcissist.
Oh, God.
Yep.
I never hear that word.
Was that?
I never hear that word.
You don't hear that?
I was going to say, six times today.
I think that everyone hears that word. And I tell people because, you know, I might be sensitive because I know there are certain people that, you know, some people are actually dealing with abuse and control and that sort of thing. So we're sensitive to it. But at the same time, in the courtroom, I tell people you have to go by the court's rules. And they are not going to play that game in terms of it doesn't necessarily mean that you're not with one, doesn't mean anything, but It doesn't, again, it doesn't help your case, unless there's an actual diagnosis and you can prove behavior. And so really you have to prove behavior anyway, but what has happened, what's, behind the scenes and in your world, what happens when someone brings up the word narcissist or starts making those type of accusations?
So first and foremost, when clients come in to talk to me, I don't minimize anything they're saying about their own experience and what they've lived through. It's a word that gets thrown around quite a bit, and I think to further your point, I don't like when my clients diagnose somebody if there's not a formal medical, clinical, psychological diagnosis. I think that gets people in trouble. So to answer your question about how does it help or hurt your case, the follow-up question is, well, sir, well, ma'am, do you have any proof that this person's been diagnosed as so-and-so? There isn't any, is there? So you have to be very careful how you label people, without a doubt. And I don't minimize any time that somebody comes and they can say whatever they want to me. I'd rather have them say it to me than say it someplace where they can essentially step into a hornet's nest. But sure, those labels of narcissism, gaslighting is a term that we hear all the time now. Here's the thing, and this is the thing that I need people to understand when they talk to me. Number one, in Illinois, which is where I practice, the law is not punitive in nature. So telling your story about being married to a narcissist may be a really impactful story, and it may be one for your therapist, but you're not going to get more because you've suffered with somebody who's really kind of done you dirty or been a terrible spouse. You don't get more for that. Now, putting that to the side, and when you've got young children involved, those labels are conclusory. And the real question becomes, how has this major personality flaw impacted this person's ability to parent their children? Is it something you're concerned about and why? And then how do we address those issues? Are they alienators? Are they people that are so self-absorbed that they can't take professional advice when your child has special needs, but they know more and they're in denial? Are they incapable of putting their children's interests before the things that they want for their children? I need specific examples of why this label impacts your kids' lives. And then that's something that we need to build on and figure out how to protect those kids.
Taking that one step further, people who've had bad experiences in relationships and marriage, and maybe they have a background where they're more affluent, public figure, those sorts of things. A lot of times they get a little gun shy about getting into another relationship and getting into a dating scene because of the experience, because they've been through a smear campaign, those sorts of things. What advice would you give someone who's in that type of situation? How can they move their life forward and simultaneously, like, kind of protect themselves where they're not leaving themselves open to that sort of situation again?
Well, I mean, I think you have to know where you made mistakes in previous relationships, but I also think that being that cynical and that untrusting is really an unhealthy way to live. And not every date you go on, you have to play out to a horrible conclusion. I do find, interestingly enough, that people that have money, of course, are more susceptible to being used by people who don't. Older people being used by younger people that don't have money. And I will tell you, that's a gender neutral statement. I see women get exploited just as much as men do. And so it's always, I'd say it's easier in that demographic to be dating somebody that isn't reliant upon you for, their lifestyle, their livelihood to pay their bills. It's always healthier when two people can kind of care for themselves. But I think the real key also is to try to balance some level of being self-protective with also not being so skeptical that you shouldn't go talk to somebody or kind of vet it a little bit. But you also you don't want somebody to be skeptical or cynical, but you also don't want somebody who's coming out of maybe a very, very terrible relationship to be too vulnerable also. And I've seen that happen so many times where somebody is engaged very, very quickly or in a very intense monogamous relationship very, very quickly, and you just know that they're still fragile and wounded and they just aren't ready yet.
When you say quickly, like, what type of time frame, like, is there a time frame that you would say, like, this is going a little bit too fast?
It depends because a lot of people are grieving the end of their marriage before it actually physically ends. People can be two ships passing in the night for a number of years, and someone's so ready to move on, irrespective of whether, the stamp that the judge puts on to finalize a judgment is done today and then someone's moved on 3 months later or 3 years later. It really kind of depends on when that other relationship ended. You know, the opposite of love isn't hate, it's ambivalence.
Right.
And a lot of times when people become indifferent in a relationship, they're ready much sooner than other people.
Yeah.
So it's I hate answering questions with it depends.
Right.
But I really do think that it really kind of matters on where you are. Because when, you know, when you get divorced, there is a grieving process. Sometimes it starts with people very early on and they're ready, and sometimes it doesn't.
The other thing that I think a lot of people don't realize is that divorce is actually a trauma too. So
big time.
You know, if you think of it from that perspective, and you've just been traumatized, you know, so do you feel that after being traumatized that you're ready to, have you even talked to anyone about the trauma that you just went through? And, you know, to your point, like, you know, you said, it depends on how bad that trauma was. Was this a high conflict situation and, you know, you had to move and you've had to find another job and you were bankrupt, like where you actually had multiple different impacts, multiple different levels of trauma. You lost a child through this process, you know, or was it pretty civil, you know, and, you know, you kind of already knew how things were going to end. You wait, you know, you're able to still communicate. You're able to talk to the kids, even if it's your week off and that sort of thing. You know, I think that those type of impacts just impact people very, very differently.
Totally. And talking to somebody is still, even in the year 2024, challenging for some people.
Yeah.
I will say specifically more like my alpha male clients.
Yeah.
It's tough to lead a horse to water, to say everybody, anybody, no matter how strong, well-adjusted, tough you are, when you're in trauma, you take care of your body, you take care of your mind, you need to take care of your emotional well-being here and your mental health. And there's no shame. And I can't believe I'm even saying this in the year that we're at, with everybody so evolved, with therapy being such a seminal part of our own self-care regimen.
Right.
So many people are still really opposed to it. They think that they're invincible.
Yeah.
And I would suggest that the right therapist is there for anybody that can help anyone through that trauma that you're describing. And there's not a person on earth that probably wouldn't benefit from it.
Right. Absolutely. 100%. Brian, this has been absolutely amazing. You are a wealth of knowledge and you have a lot of experience, both personally and professionally. We appreciate so much of your time. Can you tell people where people can find you at if they want to learn more, if they want to follow your journey, if they have a friend or family member, or if they want to contact you or your firm?
People can certainly find us. So my firm is called Berger Schatz. I've been at the firm now for 19 plus years. Started as a pretty much close to a baby lawyer, if not a toddler lawyer here. And have kind of climbed every ring since. And I've been a principal here now for 10 years. My partners and I think have created a wonderful work culture and caregiving culture for all of our clients. We're based in Chicago. We practice in downtown Chicago as well as surrounding suburbs. You can look me up online, Google me, you'll find the firm, you'll find my bio. And I will say that, you know, I've worked hard personally on my bio online because I really do want people to be able to read up and see the way that I and we do things. And I think it's a relatively authentic message about the way that I want to conduct this line of work, the way that I want to take care of clients, the way that I perceive the business that I'm in relationships. And if anybody ever wanted to reach out, they certainly can find me there.
And if you're watching this on YouTube, or if you're listening to this on the podcast, whether it be on Spotify or on Apple Podcasts, all of his information will be down in the show notes. You can go down below, all of his social media handles. Tell us in the comment sections some takeaways that you may have taken away from today's episode, something that you learned that maybe you didn't know about. And also go to all of his social media, give him some love, give him some extra follows, tell him thank you. And also let him know some things that you took away from today's episode. With all that being said, thank you so much. And we will see you on the next episode. You guys have a great
week. Thank you, Matt.